Because just knowing the truth, but not doing the truth, that doesn't do anybody any good, does it? That's the series that we're in right now. We're in this series called Pure Wisdom, and it's a series on the book of Proverbs. The book of Proverbs is this collected wisdom over thousands of years of Hebrew scriptures compacted into these juicy bite-sized nuggets. But as wise as the statements in the book of Proverbs are, they don't really do us any good unless we apply them to our lives. I like to think of myself as wise, but I don't always do really wise things, shockingly. By the way, my name's John. I'm a pastor here at Beaverton Christian Church, and I'd like to tell you a story about me and my friend Samuel. Samuel's great. Samuel's not with us today. He would normally be up there in the crow's nest, making sure the lights are correct for all the different spots. And Samuel, he's great. Samuel invited me to his mother's wake a couple of weeks ago. His mom passed away. She was a lovely woman, loved Jesus, and so the whole community was gathering together to celebrate her life. When I arrived at the wake, it became immediately obvious that I was the only person in the room not from Ghana. Now, if you're here today and you're like, what do you mean by that? Well, Ghana is this country in West Africa. And Samuel's from West Africa. And so Samuel invited me to go to this wake, and I was there, and I was kind of like, oh yeah, these people are all from a really wonderful African kingdom with castles, and leopards, lions, tremendous history. I live in West Sherwood. We have a skating rink. Gophers. But they were all really sweet to me. They were really great. They offered me food, and they had this tremendous food. I got a picture of the food they offered me here. The food, there's this big, it's like fish steak right there. There's this big hunk of broiled fish, and then all this this really flavorful rice. It was really, really good. I was going through the line, and I was putting the food on my plate, and I got, see that little green stuff up in the corner? Up in the top? There's that little dab of green. That's all they would let me put on my plate. I went to put some on. I'm like, ooh, that looks really good. So I started putting it on. They're like, nope, you can't have that. And I was like, what? And they're like, you don't want any of that. And I was like, yes, I do. I do. I want that. That's why I have it on my spoon. And they were like, no, no, that's really spicy. You can't handle that. And I was like, please. I went to college in San Diego. Like, I can eat hot stuff. Like, Tabasco, Tabasco's like ketchup for me. And they were like, trust us, you don't want any part of that. It's not anything you want in your life. And the more they said I didn't want it, the more I was kind of like, but I do want it, actually. And the more they told me I couldn't handle it, the more I really believed in myself, that I could handle it. That I was the kind of man that could have spicy green stuff at in a room full of people who seemed to be experts on their culture. So they were like, fine, okay, knock yourself out. You know where this is going, right? So just as a demonstration of goodwill and to show them how tough that I was, I took my pinky finger and I just dabbed my pinky finger just in a little bit of it, right? And then I went like this to put it in my mouth. And right about here, right? That's when like my throat caught wind of what I was putting in my mouth. Like there was like a vapor or a scent that accompanied it, right? And my throat immediately just like closed up, right? I was like, but I put it on my tongue, right? I put it on my tongue and it was okay. I was like, these people don't know what I'm from Sherwood. And I kid you not, that's when it suddenly felt like fire ants had taken like a blowtorch and then like ignited some white phosphorus on my tongue. I decided to play it cool, like you do in situations like this, right? So I'm standing in this room and they're all looking at me like this. You know how people don't have to say, I told you so, if they know how to look at you, right? They know they can look at you real good. They're just like, and I'm playing it cool, but like I needed something. Like to go outside and put my face in snow is what I needed. So I was like, can I have some water, please? And they all just immediately started laughing because it was the funniest thing. And I got to be honest, if I was them, I would have been laughing too. Because they tried to tell me, didn't they? I mean, they told me, you can't handle the truth. And I was like, I can handle this truth. And pretty soon the truth was, no, I couldn't handle the truth. I wished at that moment that Samuel had run across the room, right? And had dove through the air. No, in slow motion, and slapped my hand away from my mouth. But if he had done that, what would my response have been? The exact same as it had been all along. Who do you think you are to tell me, I know myself, I know what I want, I know what I'm doing here? But you know what I didn't know anything about? I didn't know anything about that little green sauce, did I? And people who did know were trying to tell me. And at some point in time, what I believed and what I thought and what was important to me really wasn't as important as the truth about that little green sauce, was it? And that's what we're talking about today. We're talking about the words that we use to communicate to other people. Sometimes they don't know what they don't know. And when they don't know what they don't know, we like to ramp up and we like to increase what our words do. Because we think we're going to help, but in some cases, what we do because we don't think we're being heard is we come in full blast, real strong, over the top, really hoping to prevent something when what we're really doing is we're ratcheting down and ensuring that things might happen. Because words have power, don't they? Words have power to influence. Words have power to shape and move and cause and do. And so in the book of Proverbs, the proverb we're looking at today, it's from Proverbs chapter 12, verse 18, and it's very simple. It says, "The words of the reckless pierce like swords, but the tongue of the wise brings healing." The words of the reckless pierce like swords. So words, they can either cut you to the heart, or they can bring healing to you. You've experienced this, haven't you? Remember that old saying, "Sticks and stones can break my bones, but words will never hurt me"? Yeah, that's like maybe one of the worst lies ever. Because words absolutely do hurt, don't they? And words hurt us in very specific ways. Words will shape our own image and view of ourselves. And we will believe things about ourselves based on things other people said to us. Things that other people said to us will shape our destiny. And we'll believe them and we'll live out of those things. When in reality, God believes something totally different about us. And he wants something more for us than those people wanted for us. And so, especially in today's society, where things are so polarized, and people have such strong opinions, and they go back and forth at each other with words, and the damage that comes back and forth, we actually have an opportunity as people who are following Jesus, who believe in him, to bring healing to people, to bring healing to situations when we use our tongues with wisdom, when we use wise words. Now, here's what I want you to know. I want you to know that it says, reckless words pierce like swords. Reckless words. Recklessness, that's when we intend to hurt, doesn't it? When we think to ourselves, you tried to show me, but I'm going to show you, or you got me, now I'm going to get you back. Where there's an intention, our ego or our pride has been damaged, and so we're going to inflict some pain back. That hurt and that pride that is in play, it's a desperate attempt to let the other person know you've gone too far, and I'm going to establish this painful boundary back with you. Let me ask you this question. Does it ever work, though? Does it ever work? Someone gets you, so you get them back, and they think, all's fair. I mean, I really did get them first. No, in fact, you know what we say? Well, that was worse than I did up front. So I need to get them back again. And next thing you know, all that payback escalates, and the relationship is broken. And you don't have to hurt someone by intending, do you? Husbands? How many times have you been told as a spouse, just in general, you hurt my feelings this way, and then the response is, well, I didn't mean to, so you shouldn't have hurt feelings. That doesn't immediately erase the hurt feeling, does it, at all? No, it doesn't. Intention doesn't always equal the outcome. And so many times in our life, we hurt recklessly, but oftentimes we just hurt carelessly. And so it leaves us in this really difficult spot where if we really, really want to heal, if we want to make things right, if we want to look at people and see them as they are and call them into what God's best is for them, then we really have to have sincere concern and a desire for humble honesty. That sincere concern. This is something we talk a lot about when we talk about the scriptures. That God, because he loved us, he had sincere concern for us. He made sacrifices for us. That's what puts us in the situation we're in today. And so everything we do has to be motivated out of a sincere concern. Now that sincere concern is the thing that caused every single person around that table of hot green stuff to say, don't put that in your mouth. And they were saying it with a humble honesty. You can't handle that. It's not for you. But I didn't have any humility in the process either. I had a much too high estimation of myself. And so everyone has to commit to sincere concern and humble honesty if wisdom is going to pass from person to person. That's what it takes. For the next few moments, I want to look at a little diagram, and I didn't come up with this diagram. An author named Jill Scott in her book Radical Candor came up with this diagram, and she didn't write it to Christians. She just wrote it because it's true, and I think when we see this, you'll go, oh, yeah, that makes perfect sense to me. And when we read the scriptures, we see the things in the scriptures taking place exactly as her diagram does, and I'm just using it to demonstrate to you what it is we fall into, because every single one of us chooses to be either a feeler or a thinker. You know what I'm talking about right now, thinkers? You kind of process everything as binary information. It's really easy for you to be rational and logical and come up with what should be done next. And you know what's really difficult? Is all those other idiots out there won't listen to you when you tell them what should be done. Because it makes perfect sense to you, doesn't it? If you just look at this logically and you remove yourself from the emotion of it all, this is what we ought to do. And you tend to say things like this. Look, I'm just telling the truth here. Hey, I just want you to know the truth. I'm more concerned about telling things the way they are. Now, some of you are here in the room today and you know what you're thinking? Those people are jerks. That's because you're not the person who leans into thinking when it comes to communication. You're the person who leans into feeling. You're the person who's not so much concerned about logic. You're concerned about how things are or how people respond. You're concerned with feelings, right? And as much as that other person will leverage information and facts to get their way, you will leverage philosophies, feelings, thoughts. What would society be like if everyone acted the way you did? We'd be a bunch of robots. Depending on your outlook on life, whether you tend to be a thinker or a feeler, you will lean into one of those communication styles. And that communication style, unfortunately, doesn't guarantee success. It doesn't guarantee success because every single one of us faces this very specific human problem. Jesus' brother James said that what causes fights among us is that we all want our own way and we're willing to engage in violence to get it. Every one of us struggles with self-centeredness, and we're either willing to get physically violent or emotionally violent or mentally violent. We're willing to use words with subtle violence to get what we want. And so we lean one of these two directions, either hoping to convince other people to our way of thinking, because if we convince them to our way of thinking, then we get our way, or we try to help them understand our way of feeling, so that they will experience success in feeling better. So this little chart I want to show you, it starts with challenging directly. Truth speakers, people who love to speak the truth, they love to come right at you. I'm going to tell you the truth right here in this situation. And if you can't handle it, I'm sorry, but that's just the way it is. Now, the other group of people, right, they tend to care personally, and they're always looking to give grace. When I was a child, I came home, I had gotten caught cheating on a book report. You might think, how do you cheat on a book report? Didn't read a book, I just made up a book report about a book that didn't exist. My father wanted to kill me. He was a truth giver. My mother begged for my life. One person was grace giving, the other person was truth speaking. Now here's the real difficult thing, right? Truth speaking on its own, just telling the truth, that's obnoxious aggression. I don't care about you, I just care about the truth, and I'm gonna put it out there and everyone can just deal if they don't like it. Obnoxious aggression is just fundamentally a misunderstanding of how to care about the truth. But now if you're not interested in truth, you're just interested in feelings and offering grace in every situation, that's just called ruinous empathy, right? Grace giving without truth, that's just unwarranted affirmation. And what it does is it locks people into a very specific kind of self-blindness, and they tend to feel like everything's gonna be okay, even when it's not. Now, there are some of us that we don't split the difference on one of those two. We just don't do anything, right? And this other one, this is called manipulative insincerity. When we don't care about people and we don't care about the truth, we just care about getting what we want. And so we will do whatever it takes in any situation to achieve it. That's kissing up to people and kicking other people down when they're in our way. And that manipulative insincerity is probably the most destructive thing that we experience in our relationships. Because in the end, what we're saying is, I don't really care about the truth or other people. I'm loyal only to myself. I don't know who I can please, so instead I'm gonna please myself. And this is kind of where we're stuck as a society, isn't it? There are people who they only care about the truth. You've seen their Twitter feeds. And there are people who really only care about how they feel. You've seen them crying. And then there are people who said, I'm so sick of both sides of that, I'm just checking out. And what this means is that words end up hurting and wisdom doesn't pass from person to person or from place to place. So there's gotta be a different way. Now, the scripture says that Jesus did things a different way, that when Jesus arrived, Jesus was God in the flesh. And Jesus' close friend John, he wrote a story about Jesus' life. It's in the book of John. And I want to show you a verse from the book of John. John does this really poetic thing where he refers to Jesus as the word of love that God spoke to us. That Jesus is this word of God spoke to us. Word of love. And so Jesus, John says this about Jesus. He says, the word, Jesus, became flesh. He became flesh and made his dwelling among us. And we have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son, God's only Son, who came from the Father full of grace and truth. Grace and truth. He didn't pick one over the other. He did both, grace and truth. He was filled with grace and truth. He didn't just spit the truth and tell people to deal, and he didn't just love and hope that people would be okay. He did both. And if you're looking here at the graphic, grace and truth, that's going to be an upper corner where we offer grace, we offer truth. That's called radical candor. That's the willingness to be honest like nobody else is honest. Honest with care. It's truth speaking and grace giving. And the scriptures record Jesus doing this all the time, but my favorite illustration of it is in this scenario where Jesus is teaching and he's having a conversation, and all of a sudden the religious leaders of the day drag this woman in. And this woman's been caught in an adulterous relationship. Now, they lived in a time period before the separation of church and state, so their religious laws demanded that this woman be put to death for her crimes. So now they think they've got Jesus in a box. Jesus, are you gonna speak truth or are you gonna give grace? Because if you speak truth, then we get to kill her. And if you give grace, well, then we can prove that you're really not a morally righteous man. And so Jesus handled the situation incredibly, incredibly well because he does both. He just waits for a period of time and then he says, how about this? Anyone here who's never done anything wrong before can go ahead and put her to death. So one by one, everybody peels off because everybody's guilty of something. And then he says to the woman, where are all the people who accuse you? And she says, they're gone. They left. And Jesus says, neither do I condemn you, grace. Go and sin no more, truth. I do not condemn you, but you need to stop what you're doing. Grace and truth. And throughout the scriptures, we see Jesus offering this kind of radical candor where he tells the truth, but he does it with kindness and love because he wants to see people experience healing, the healing that comes from pure wisdom. So if you have your Bibles with me, open them to the book of Matthew. In the book of Matthew, we're going to look at a passage of scripture where we see Jesus teaching on this. And in Matthew chapter 12, verse 33, we're going to see Jesus confronting a group of people who they cared about truth, they did not care about people. And in the end, as he investigates it, he comes to realize they don't actually even care about the truth either. It's these same religious leaders that Jesus is having a conversation with. Matthew was another one of Jesus' friends. He was a tax collector, which means he worked for the government, the Roman Empire, and he had all kind of free will to twist people's arms to get as much money as he wanted from them. But when he met Jesus and saw that Jesus was doing something a different way, he set down his old life and he picked up what the life that Jesus had for him. He saw the wisdom in living the way Jesus taught and lived. He wanted to be a person of grace and truth. And so the book of Matthew is Matthew's account of Jesus' life. And Jesus is talking with the religious leaders, and he says this to them in Matthew 12, 33. Make a tree good, and its fruit will be good. Or make a tree bad, and its fruit will be bad, for a tree is recognized by its fruit. Hey, if you want to figure out if a tree is a good tree or a bad tree, all you got to do is pick the fruit and taste it, and you'll know if that tree is good or bad. That means that what's happening deep within the tree, deep under the soil, deep within the bark, is going to be evident in the fruit that's been produced. And he's using this agricultural understanding because everybody would have known what he was talking about when he said, make a tree good or make a tree bad. To make a tree good, you had to care for it. You had to work with that. There were things that you could do, right? You could dig around the tree. You could put fertilizer around the base of the trunk. You make sure it had access to water. So providing the tree with care, right, nurture, is part of making the tree good. There was something else that they understood, something that we understand now today as well. It's that you have to provide the plant with access to resources, but you can't make it easy. The tree has to actually work. So you can nurture that tree by showing it care, but you've also got to use some discipline with that tree. In Oregon, we're starting to grow some really good grapes for wine out in Yamhill County. And you know what they came to understand as they were starting the process of tearing out all the filbert orchards and planting wine grapes about 20 years ago? They came to realize that the best grapes produced in the region weren't the ones that had it the easiest. It was the ones that had it the hardest. That the plant has to work really hard to produce that really good grape. And so it's care, providing resource, but discipline, making it work, that actually makes the tree good. And so in our lives, what we need to do is actually have access to the resources we need, to the good things we need, but there's also this very specific discipline in our life. Jesus provided us his righteousness. He made it available to us when he died on the cross for us in our place. But then when he asks for obedience, that's the discipline, that listening to his voice and responding correctly, immediately, that causes us to grow. And the best fruit, the best good works that are produced in our life happen because we recognize that Jesus cares for us, but he's calling us to work in ways that transform us from the inside out through obedience to his word. Jesus says that you make that tree good and good produce will come from it. And if you want to know what kind of a tree it is, you just check the fruit. Which means if you want to know what kind of a person you are, look at the words that you use, look at how you speak to people, scroll back through your history and ask yourself, is this grace, is this truth, or is this both? Because both is what it takes to live like Jesus. It's really hard sometimes. I'll scroll back through the things that I've tweeted or the things that I've texted or the things that I've posted on a status update, and I think, man, I really wish I had never written that. I drove past a really corny sign the other day. You know what it said? Tweet others the way you want to be tweeted. And it was super corny, but I really wished I'd thought of it. Because instead, I lean into one or the other and I pick for myself instead of doing what Jesus is asking me to do. But if I want to bring healing, I've got to go beyond that. And so Jesus is confronting these religious leaders, people who are capable of doing things like dragging out a woman and wanting Jesus to kill her. And in confronting them, he says this, "You brood of vipers, how can you who are evil say anything good? For the mouth speaks what the heart is full of. The mouth speaks what the heart is full of. You brood of vipers. He's saying you are the children of snakes. There's some very specific snakes that live in the Middle East. The one that Jesus is specifically talking about here is the sand viper. You brood of vipers. And the sand viper is obviously evil. Look at it. You're like, animals are not good or evil. They're just animals. That's an evil animal. I know it's not evil. The sand viper is called the asp by the Egyptians. And it's dangerous because it's filled with poison. And it's intent on delivering that poison to whatever it's going to strike. So it's an obvious danger, but it's also a subtle danger because do you see what it's doing? It's burying itself in the sand. And it will bury itself till just those two tan eyes are out of the sand. Because everything knows that that's a dangerous snake. So it has to hide itself so that it can lash out and get what it wants. And Jesus is saying, you religious leaders, you people who claim to care about the truth but don't care about people, you are like little snakes. You're obviously dangerous, but you hide yourself and your poison deep inside, and you're looking to release it at any moment. How can you who are evil say anything good? You see, our words deliver what's hidden deep, hidden away deep inside of us. If you want to know what kind of person you are, examine the words that you use. If you want to see the areas of your life that Jesus needs to have control over, that you need to surrender to God's Spirit in, look at the things that you say. Look at what you've written out. That's when we're most truly confronted with our true self. Not the us we want to present to the world, but the us that's lying in wait. Jesus says that a good man brings good things out of the good stored up in him. And an evil man brings evil things out of the evil stored up in him. That there's this there's either this accumulation of internal evil in our lives or an accumulation of internal good in our lives. We accumulate internal evil by living self-centeredly, by living selfishly, by lashing out with violence, the things we think about, the things that we move on. If it's self-indulgent, then it's indulging that broken humanity, that part of us that wants what it wants and is willing to fight to get it. But we accumulate good. We let Jesus' righteousness come to our lives when we indulge the life of the Spirit, when we listen to his word, when we meditate on what he wants, when we see people the way he sees them, not the way we see them, not the way we need them to be, but the way he sees them as loved and cared for, people he desires to offer his life to. One of these two things is always spilling out of us, our accumulated good or our accumulated evil. I spent a summer when I was in college as a camp counselor. I loved it. It was great. I got to meet children and help them discover how much God loved them and how much he wanted them to grow to be like Jesus. And that was the job, helping kids discover God and how much he wanted them to be like Jesus. But in the afternoons, we would ride dirt bikes. It was a dirt bike camp. And so we would take these fourth, fifth, and sixth graders and we would teach them how to ride motorcycles. And they'd start on day one not knowing anything. And by the end of the week, they could ride their dirt bike. And for like 11 weeks, that's what I did. And I can assure you that the hardest part of it was this. On day one, kids would come down, they'd have their helmets and their little goggles on, and they'd be so excited to ride that motorcycle that they'd all have to learn what the motorcycle was before they could ride it. So you had to talk through everything, and you'd get to the end of the first, like, these are the handlebars, this is the clutch, this is the brakes, this is the tires, this is the part you gotta watch out. You go through the whole thing, and at the end you say, any questions? And no kid would ever ask a question like, can we go over that thing about the clutch again? They'd always say, when can we ride the motorcycles? And you'd have to explain to them, well, we've got to now learn how to start the motorcycle before we can ride it. And then you'd walk through standing over the motorcycle and using the Kickstarter to get it fired up. And you'd go through the whole thing. And at the end of that second period of time on the first day, you'd say, now, are there any questions? And no kid would ever ask, now help me understand what an internal combustion engine does. The question would always be, when do we get to ride the motorcycles? And you have to say, well, now you have to learn how to control the motorcycle now that you've got the power engaged, and you go through that whole piece, right? You get to the end of the third session. At the end of the third session, you say, now, are there any questions? And no kid would ask any question other than this one. When do we get to ride the motorcycles? So you can imagine after 9 weeks of this, it would get a little tiresome. And I remember standing out there in the rain one day, it's just pouring down rain, and we're at the third sequence, and it's now time for the third series of questions, but it's gonna be the first question the third time. And we were in this really weird spot where the same kid had asked the first question, the same kid had asked the second question, and now the hand is raised, and the exact same kid is going to ask the first question. And I don't know what happened, but I lost it. Because when I called on him and he said, yeah, when are we going to ride the motorcycles? Do you know what I said? Now is when we're going to ride the motorcycles. Go, do it. Just ride it. Go right now. Ride right out into the field. You can go onto the trails. You can go over the jumps. You can do anything. Just go. And the kid got so excited. He was like, you could see his little eyes behind the goggles. He was like, and then he kind of was like, and I was like, and you don't even have to come back here. You can just keep riding all the way home. You can keep the motorcycle. And that's when, like, I could see the look be in his little eyes that he understood what was happening. Right? That I was making fun of him. And he started to get, his goggles started to get a little foggy and his little shoulders started to slump over. And I was like, what are you crying about? And he says, I just want to ride the motorcycle, but you're making fun of me. And I said, and you can't ride the motorcycle, can you? And he was like, no. And I said, the truth hurts, doesn't it? Yeah, you're like, you are a terrible person. The truth actually hurts, which is why we use it as a weapon to get what we want. To hurt and to break, to touch in ways that we shouldn't touch, places in hearts that we don't have any right to break. That accumulation inside of us is always going to come out. The question is, are we working on that accumulation being good, or are we letting that self-centeredness drive us? Because Jesus goes on to say this, but I tell you that everyone will have to give an account on the day of judgment for every empty word they have spoken. For by your words you will be acquitted, and by your words you will be condemned. That everyone is going to give an account. And he uses this very specific Greek word for empty here. It's the Greek word for argon. It says idle, lazy, or thoughtless. That even the careless words that we throw out there are going to come back. And God is going to ask us why we said it. He's going to ask us to give an account of why we used the words that we did. Every single one of us will answer to God for what we said, how we said it, and why we said it. Which is a tremendous motivation to be spending time with God in His Spirit, listening to His truth, so that we can say honest things in kind ways. Honest things in kind ways. So before we leave today, I want to talk about ways that we can say honest things in kind ways. And I think it would change the way we live our lives with our family, with our friends, in our school, at our job. That if we were known as people who were able to live out of radical candor because we care deeply, we care personally, but we actually confront directly, people would begin to respect not just us, but the truth that we're trying to live out. So the first thing is this. Don't ever automatically assume that you're right. Even if you think you have a Bible verse that puts you in the clear. Don't automatically assume you're right. Automatically assuming that we're right is like saying, I have a godlike power to know everything I need to know. You know that there's a difference between honesty and the truth, don't you? Honesty is us sharing how we're truly feeling. But the truth, that can be entirely different. You ever get cut off in traffic? And so you immediately begin telling yourself a story about that other person based on what you can see, the kind of car they're driving, the ethnicity of the person operating the vehicle, the gender of the person operating the vehicle. None of these things are true. It's us filling in what we don't know about why we got cut off with what we can see and what we have previously experienced. We assemble stories to help us understand our experiences. And when we share those stories, we're being honest, but it's not always true. So whenever you go into a situation where you have to challenge someone directly, ask good questions about it. When you said this, it made me feel this way. Why did you say that? How would you like me to respond in this situation based on what you just said? No, what we tend to do is, you're a huge jerk and you always do this and you're bothering people everywhere and I'm gonna be the person to stand up to you. We assume we know everything we need to know. Maybe the person was headed to the hospital. Maybe the accelerator was stuck on their car. Maybe they just didn't see you. We always associate these extreme levels of disrespect because we're self-centered and we want what we want. Speak directly to that person, not someone else. Jesus makes this really clear in the book of Matthew when he says, hey, if you've got a problem, go talk to that person directly. If that doesn't sort it out, bring a friend to talk to that person directly. Talking to someone who's not involved, who may actually be a good friend of yours, or who may actually know the other person, that just spreads the problem. It hurts that other person's reputation. It may help us feel understood, but it doesn't get us a step towards solving the issue. Whenever someone comes to me and they're like, do you know what such and such did or what so-and-so said? One of the first things I ask is, well, have you spoken with them about that? You'd be shocked at the number of times people go, oh, not yet. You should go talk to them about that. I would encourage you to go talk to that person. I'm sure it's a misunderstanding. I'm sure they didn't intend what you're feeling. We speak kindly about behavior, not about character. See, what I want to say is, you're a jerk, you're an idiot, you're mean, you're insensitive. All of those things are labeling someone with bad character. This is the kind of person that you are. When instead I can speak kindly about their behavior, I'm not sure you understand how you're coming across when you say this. It's giving it an opportunity for it to be a mistake or a misunderstanding or ignorance. Ask questions about them, make statements about yourself. I was once told, you can tell if you're in the middle of a bad conversation if the person is making statements about you and asking questions about themselves. It sounds like this. You're the worst person in the world. How could I possibly be your friend? I can't know. How can you possibly be my friend? It sounds like I'm the worst person in the world. But when we make statements about ourselves and we ask questions about them, we're inviting a conversation. That's saying, I want to get to know the truth, not just castigate you with my story. Make statements about yourself, ask questions about them. Now, challenging directly is important, but it has to be done in conjunction with caring personally. This means you have to cultivate personal humility. And we say this all the time, but personal humility is cultivated in time spent with God. As long as I focus on all the awesome things I do, I'm gonna keep thinking I'm an awesome person. Man, I eat a lot of hot chilies and I think I'm pretty awesome. And as long as I focus on all the areas that I fail, man, I went to this party full of people from Africa and I ate a chili and it was too hot and I looked like a fool. I will either feel miserable about myself or too good about myself. But if I spend time with God and see how good he is, now I know where I fit in the scheme of things. And I don't feel bad because he loves me. And I don't feel like I'm amazing because I see that he actually is amazing. You have to spend time with God to cultivate personal humility. If you want to care personally, you have to pursue loving and knowing. To pursue people to know them and love them. And then just let being known and loved happen. See, so often we go to people desperate to be understood, so we spend all of our time talking at them, that you'll understand me and then you'll care. When the truth is, when we care for them, they begin caring for us in return. And if you care for somebody that doesn't care for you back, that's a bad relationship. Get out of it. Pursue loving others and knowing them, and then receive being loved and being known. Work it the opposite direction than you would naturally feel. Focus on influence and not control. None of us can make anyone do anything they don't want to do. They could not get me to not eat that hot pepper. They couldn't. But guess whose advice I listened to the entire rest of the party? Should I try some of that? Is that very good? Yeah. When I failed, I saw how important their influence was in my life. We keep the relationships open so that we can influence for positive things. So we care personally, we challenge directly. And in this, we're just not offering people something we don't want to receive in return. That's why Jesus, who loved God and loved others, loved the truth and spoke kindly to them. And you might be thinking, but John, he called them a brood of vipers. He said some things that I don't think maybe I should say. Let me tell you this. Jesus knew some things that we don't know. Scripture says three different locations that Jesus, who knew men's thoughts, Jesus, who knew their hearts, Jesus, who knew what they were thinking among themselves, Jesus had the ability to know people's hearts and their minds, which is why he stepped in and he judged character. But you and I, we don't have that power. And if we want to set down our desire for God-like power, we will live like Jesus lived, and trust that he knows their hearts, not us. And we're calling and influencing them to something more and something better. Speaking kindly to that level of behavior, leaving the character piece alone, and calling them forward into what God has best for them. And when we do that, we're demonstrating pure wisdom. The pure wisdom that comes when we are willing to love the truth and love people the way God does.